Welcome back. I hope you, during the break, managed to get some sustenance. We continue with the intellectual sustenance with Lucas Townsend, originally from the United States, associate editor of the International Journal of James Bond Studies.
It's true.
Entering the third year of his PhD at Roehampton University, and the provisional, more than provisional, it sounds like quite, you've already decided this is the title of your PhD.
Oh, yes.
To hand in about 2 years' time from now.
Something like that.
The Intermodernist Poetics of Ian Fleming and Graham Greene is his PhD title, and the title of his talk is up there on the screen in front of you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Yes, thank you very much, everybody. I just want to warn you that my voice is dying and has been all morning. I think it's because we were on the common for too long yesterday and it got quite cold. And I woke up and it's quite hard to talk, so I'm going to be sucking on this throat lozenge thing the whole time. That's why I have an expanded cheek. So hopefully you can bear with that, and thank you if I stop to drink water and whatnot. But title of this presentation, as Chris informed you, is up on the screen, but is Ian Fleming's and Graham Greene's intertextual thrillers, Brown, Bond, and Bertram Against the World. Now, I want to begin with a little game. Can you all tell me if this is a Graham Greene quote or an Ian Fleming quote? I had ordered two very dry martinis, and he brought them to us quite drowned in vermouth. I could tell at once from the color without tasting. To make matters worse, he tried to explain away the color by saying he had only used Booth's gin. But you know perfectly well I only take Gordon's, I said and sent them back. He brought me two more, and he had put lemon peel in them. Is a Fleming quote or a Greene quote? You'd all be wrong. This is from Graham Greene's Loser Takes All. Let's try the next one. I'm getting very sorry for the devil. The devil has a rotten time, and I always like to be on the side of the underdog. We don't give the poor chap a chance. There's a good book about goodness and how to be good and so forth, but there's no evil book about evil and how to be bad. The devil has no prophets to write his Ten Commandments and no team of authors to write his biography. His case is gone completely by default. We know nothing about him except a lot of fairy stories from our parents and schoolmasters. He has no book from which we can learn about the nature of evil in all its forms, with parables about evil people, proverbs about evil people, folklore about evil people. Fleming. This is indeed Fleming, but it could have been from one of Greene's minor essays or something. This is from Casino Royale. And we'll do one more. There had been something curiously impressive about the death of the Mexican. It wasn't that he hadn't deserved to die. He had been an instrument of pain and misery all his life. But when he died, life had gone out of the body so quickly, so utterly, that he'd almost seen it come out of his mouth as it does in the shape of a bird in Haitian privatives. What an extraordinary difference there was between a body full of a person and a body that was empty. The difference, the thing that had gone out of the stinking Mexican bandit, was greater than all of Mexico. What green is this from? What's that? The Power and the Glory? This is from Fleming's Goldfinger. So, thank you all for indulging me in that. So, famous writer, well-traveled reporter, occasional intelligence agent, active film commentator, hater of American consumerism, heavy drinker, heavy womanizer, a depressed man, suicide contemplator, a man whose schoolboy bullies haunted him for the rest of his life. I'm not, in fact, talking about Graham Greene. I'm talking about Ian Fleming. Fleming was born in 1908 to a well-to-do family in Oxfordshire, the second brother of four, son to the MP of Henley, Valentine Fleming, and a domineering mother, Evelyn St. Croix. Fleming's early life, and indeed into his adulthood, was lived in the shadow of his more attractive, more intelligent, more successful older brother, Peter. The shy Ian was regularly bullied at the Spartan Durnford Prep School in Dorset by his headmaster and his classmates, and it was here as a nine-year-old he learned of his father's death at the Somme in 1917. From Durnford, he went on to Eton, where he kept a constant stream of girls, cars, and motorcycles before he was removed a term early and placed in Sandhurst Military Academy. Fleming didn't last 6 months here, dropping out due to a case of gonorrhea. His controlling mother, who, by the way, Fleming referred to his mother as M, was not having any of this and put Fleming into a string of language schools across Europe in preparation for the Foreign Office exam. He failed twice. Fleming's mother blamed his sudden engagement to a girl in Austria. She forced him to break it off and come home to seek a job in stockbroking. An associate labeled him the world's worst stockbroker. Finally, Fleming secured a job with Reuters, where he excelled in foreign reporting, and after working unofficially with British Secret Service on reporting trips to Russia, he joined British Naval Intelligence in World War II, where he served as a liaison to multiple other branches of intelligence, as well as personal secretary to Admiral John Godfrey, another inspiration for M. He did this while he was also maintaining a string of personal affairs, including with a married Viscountess Anne Charteris, who would later become his wife. Fleming was praised for his creativity and daring in organizing commando raids and other operations, as well as establishing contacts with other branches, including assisting in the creation of the American CIA. On one such conference in Jamaica, Fleming decided to winter there for the rest of his life and write books. It was in Jamaica, in Fleming's sparse bungalow, Goldeneye, where Fleming composed a Bond novel every year until his death in 1964 from a second massive heart attack. Smoking 60 cigarettes a day and drinking half a bottle of liquor a day will do that to you. Now, I wish to display for all of you the interpersonal relationships and connections between Fleming and Green in order to demonstrate their closeness and to map the circles in which they both moved, as they have a greater number than one would initially expect. Most obviously, Fleming and Green both worked for MI6 in some capacity before, during, and after World War II. Green's uncle, William Graham Green, was one of the founders of British Naval Intelligence, in which Fleming's primary wartime allegiances lay. However, their connections go beyond just espionage. Fleming's brother Peter, the successful travel writer, was one of the founding members of Green's ill-fated magazine Night and Day. Fleming's best friend was the actor Noel Coward, who we know from his role as Hawthorne in the filmic Our Man in Havana. Fleming was neighbors with and frequent host of Coward at his Jamaican home, Goldeneye, who Coward referred to as Goldeneye Nose and Throat due to its clinical appearance. Coward also rented his house in Kent to both Fleming and Eric Ambler, another important thriller writer to both Eric Fleming and Green. Fleming and Green made use of the same psychologist, Eric Strauss, although for very different reasons. Green, his treatment for bipolar disorder, and Fleming to ensure that his depiction of his villain's megalomania was accurate. Following the war, Fleming boldly reinterpreted his job offer to be foreign editor of the Sunday Times, and instead wished to be called foreign manager of the Sunday Times to keep with his almost spymaster role in espionage, in addition to demanding 2 months paid holiday per year. It should be noted that Kemsley newspaper group passed over Malcolm Muggeridge for this role, who resented Fleming for it for the rest of his life, publishing several character assassinations of Fleming right after his death in 1964, a reputation that remains with Fleming and the character James Bond today of being misogynist and sexist. That all comes from Muggeridge. We, of course, know of Muggeridge is importance to Graham Greene as a friend and fellow MI6 agent and Catholic. Fleming's position at the Sunday Times is perhaps most important to Greene. Seeing as Fleming was foreign manager from 1945 until 1959 and stayed on in a major role until his first heart attack at an office meeting in 1961, this means that all the articles Green wrote for the Sunday Times in Kenya and Malaya and Indochina had to pass Fleming's desk at some point, meaning the two must have had a working relationship in some capacity. Fleming's wife, Anne, was a sociolite who prized herself on her literary circle of friendships, of which she would frequently exclude her husband's writing as pornography. Members of her literary set and close confidants included Elizabeth Bowen, her best male friend Evelyn Waugh, and Malcolm Muggeridge. These people have all held various degrees of importance to Green's life in publication, adventure, and religion. I also suppose we should not ignore Fleming and Green's actual in-person interactions. Green was hosted at Fleming's house 2 times that we know of, in March 1953 and in 1960. And Ian hosted Catherine Walston and Graham at Goldeneye, with Anne writing to Evelyn Waugh describing Green as such. Is he living in sin? Is he tortured? He remained remote from all, totally polite, and holding the cocktail shaker as a kind of defensive weapon. Fleming was keen to question Green on the recent defections of Burgess and MacLean to the Soviets over drinks. In November 1960, Fleming again invited Green to another holiday in Goldeneye, in exchange for Green writing an introduction to an American omnibus edition of Fleming's works. Green politely declined the introduction, saying he'd rather pay rent. However, this was an ill-fated holiday, as Green ran afoul of Fleming's Jamaican housekeeper, Violet, who Green called a villainous old housekeeper with the evil eye.
Catherine and Graham accused Violet of overcharging them £10 a week for the household goods and for stealing their whiskey. Violet responded saying that they, Graham and Catherine, constantly soiled the sheets, and if she needed the odd tot of whiskey, it was to steel herself for the job of washing them. According to John Wise, when Green confronted Violet, he claims she placed a spell on him. Shortly afterwards, he slipped over beside the swimming pool and damaged his shoulder quite severely. I need to ask him where he got that from, because it's pretty fantastic. Now, Fleming's essays make it clear that he looked up to or even idolized Green as a master of the thriller genre, stating in one interview that he was obsessed with Graham Greene because each sentence he writes interests me, both as an individual and a writer. And in his personal letters, he considers Green a friend. We're not exactly sure if Green reciprocated this idea of friendship with Fleming. But Green, at the very least, respected Fleming enough to have read not one, but three of his books. We know this since Green quotes from Casino Royale, Moonraker, and from Russia with Love in his published compendium of spy stories written with his brother Hugh, The Spy's Bedside Book. Fleming and Green also make a number of obvious references to each other's work. Christopher Hall has commented on how Our Man in Havana's mild-mannered James Wormald is implicitly the inverse or antithesis of Bond, stating that the two authors both named their fictional spies James and gave each other a 00 codename, 007 and 59-200-5, respectively. The pall of Fleming is also distinctively cast over the human factor, with the first 22,000 words having been written in the mid-1960s. This is at the height of the Bondomania movement. And the early chapters construe the character of Davis exclusively in James Bond terms. Later in the novel, Green more directly states of Fleming through two minor characters, quote, "The Colonel is one of the hush-hush boys, James Bond and all that. One of the two said, I could never read those books by Ian, too sexy for me. Exaggerated. A deep silence fell over the bar as each one was thinking of something different, of a novel by Ian Fleming, of a shooting party, or a funeral." Meanwhile, Fleming's most acclaimed novel, From Russia with Love, uses Green as a referent for the characterization of its primary villain, the Soviet assassin Red Grant. When Grant ambushes Bond on the Orient Express, Stamboul train, Bond feels that, quote, danger, like a third man, was standing in the room. And more directly upon Grant's later villainous monologue, quote, a bit of third man stuff won't do the story any harm. Sometimes these intertextual references are more tongue-in-cheek. Fleming's nonfiction chapter on Liberia's and Sierra Leone's diamond trade and the diamond smugglers is, of course, titled The Heart of the Matter. However, all of this is background for the trio of novels that I would like to cover in this presentation, of which I hope to demonstrate share some fairly major consistencies in plot, character, theme, dialogue, symbology, and resolution. These are Green's early masterpiece, Brighton Rock, Fleming's first novel, Casino Royale, and Green's forgotten stepchild of a short novella, Loser Takes All. In comparing these novels, I aim to highlight some of the unconscious influences, but more importantly, pointedly conscious, that Ian Fleming and Graham Greene used in working on these early novels. This is not to say I plan on using any sort of psychological theory stuff like Harold Bloom and his ilk to discuss that Fleming and Greene are in some sort of Oedipal emulation of each other. As tempting as this might be, given Fleming's hero worship of Greene, and the fact that Greene apparently had old jealous dreams where Catherine Walston had fallen in love with Ian Fleming. Instead, I would like to employ some theories of intertextuality in order to discuss the relationship between Green and Fleming's work. I promise I'll keep the Thorpe theory short here, but as a brief primer, Julia Kristeva, she's sort of the first person to talk about intertextuality, or to do a lot with it, she defines it as follows, that, quote, any text is constructed as a mosaic of quotations. Any text is the absorption and transformation of another. In other words, no literature exists in a vacuum. This is not exactly news, as discussed by theorists like Roland Barthes and many others. However, the specific intertextuality I'd like to talk about, starting with the connections between Brighton Rock and Casino Royale, approaches a different concept, that of Gerard Genette's hypertextuality. Now, we're getting kind of complicated here, but in brief, hypertextuality talks about a relationship of a text B, called the hypertext, to an earlier text A, called the hypotext, and they sort of have a relationship with each other that sort of copy each other. The best example of this is a hypertextual rewrite is something like James Joyce's Ulysses, which is a modernist retelling of the Odyssey. With this in mind, I am going to be arguing that Casino Royale is a reinterpreted or revised version of Brighton Rock, with Fleming using the structural bones of Pinky Brown to construct the basis of the famous character James Bond. I will then wrap up with Green's return of the favor with his gambler Bertram in Loser Takes All. Now, it is first important to acknowledge Fleming's and Green's use of secrets. Secret worlds, secret knowledge, secret access, secret organizations. A running theme that constructs the work of their thrillers. The idea of the transfer of secrets meant for espionage, photo novels, noir novels, detective novels is the focus of these. But for Fleming and Green, secrets are not just related to the movement and reporting of enemy evidence and intelligence back to base or some such, but rather the idea of the secret that they use are constructed in terms of education, school, crime, society, religion, experience, sex, suicide, and yes, knowledge of espionage and government organizations. What this does, however, is lead me towards Fleming's and Green's books really being about loyalty, betrayal, failure, and the learning and uncovering of these secrets. This is not exactly a new perspective in Green's studies, but it does give us a sort of new perspective on how to interpret both Fleming and the writing of the immediate pre- and post-World War II period, or the intermodernist period. Now, I bring this up with regards to Brian Rock, in which these themes of secrecy come to a head and help to form a thematic chrysalis for Fleming's first novel. Fleming had been batting around an idea in his head since 1944 that he was going to write the spy story to end all spy stories. In order to procrastinate on his forthcoming marriage, Fleming sat down at his gold-plated typewriter in Jamaica and wrote Casino Royale in just 4 weeks of early 1952, averaging 2,000 words a day, and published the book in 1953 to rave reviews by Somerset Maugham and Raymond Chandler. The plot in brief deals with who we now know as the famous secret agent 007, James Bond, traveling to the fictional seaside resort of Royal-les-Eaux in northern France, an imaginative place loosely based on the French gambling resort Les Touquets. Bond attempts to beat a Soviet paymaster named Le Chiffre, living beyond the means of his superiors by robbing him of his funds in a high-stakes game of baccarat. After losing all of his money, Bond is bailed out by the Americans and beats Le Chiffre with his newfound martial aid. Naturally, Le Chiffre kidnaps Bond and his beautiful assistant Vesper Lind and tortures Bond quite savagely. A vengeful Soviet agent's surprise appearance saves Bond, and he and Vesper take a long and loving holiday in the French countryside to recover, where Bond decides he will marry her. However, Vesper is revealed as having been a double agent all along, and she commits suicide instead of continuing to betray Bond. Essentially, Bond fails three times. He doesn't beat Le Chiffre with British money, he doesn't save himself from torture and kill Le Chiffre, and he doesn't even get the girl. The failures of Bond in this opening novel truly reflect a collapsing British Empire after the Second World War, with a luxurious Bond, a weakened husk of the former strength of his nation, a country that doesn't even end wartime rationing until 1954. Now, to return to the point I was making about secrets in Fleming and Green, Brighton Rock and Casino Royale are both firmly grounded in the secret worlds of loyalty, betrayal, double agents, revenge killings, and restricted information. The attainment of knowledge of power, of wealth, sex, God, and suicide are all enigmas offered up to the reader in both of these novels. In some respects, we can say that Casino Royale is not really a spy novel at all, but instead an intensely domestic novel about whom the affections of heroine-slash-villainess Vesper Lind really lie with. The central game of baccarat in which Bond defeats the Soviet paymaster Le Chiffre is just one step in the uncovering of Vesper's secret that she has been a double agent. On the other hand, we could also argue that Brighton Rock is in fact an early spy novel, dealing with at least three different organizations, Pinky's gang, Colleoni's gang, and yes, Ida's gang, each seeking to control secret information, resources, and to convince enemies to defect to them in order to maintain power, territory, and their specific ideologies from the shadows. It's no coincidence that Pinky's contacts in the Brighton criminal underworld are called the Old Firm, the same phrase that Green uses to refer to MI6 in The Human Factor. Now, the first and perhaps most important comparison to make between Brighton Rock and Casino Royale is between its two anti-hero protagonists, Pinky Brown and James Bond. At first blush, what could these two possibly have in common? Pinky's a two-bit racetrack gangster from a seaside resort slum. Bond is a virile, indestructible, savoir-faire spy who wins at all manner of games with villains and women across the globe. Let's first start with physical descriptions. Bond looks at himself in a mirror, quote, "As he tied his thin, double-ended black satin tie, he paused for a moment and examined himself. His gray-blue eyes looked calmly back with a hint of ironical inquiry, and with the thin vertical scar down his right cheek, the general effect was faintly piratical." And then he slept, with the warm and humor of his eyes extinguished, his features relapsed into a taciturn mask, ironical, brutal, and cold. Perhaps there's something in this description that complements a grown-up version of our image of Pinky. A boy of about 17 watched him from the door, a shabby smart suit, the cloth too thin for much wear, a face of starved intensity, a kind of hideous and unnatural pride. Pinky has gray and human 17-year-old eyes, a serious dead voice, a young ancient poker face. He's a crack shot. That'll be Pinky. He was always good with a gun. And Pinky, too, has a scar after his carving on the race course by Colleone's gang. He remembered with disgust that they were always said to like a scar, that they took it a mark of manhood, of potency. Later in Casino Royale, Bond is carved in his hand in the same manner as Pinky by the nameless Soviet agent to mark him as a spy forever. Our first version of Bond in Casino Royale is not actually of a spy, but of a criminal, as he's a robber planning to rob the casino in a heist. Only after Bond's mental images, the issues and dangers associated with the technical knowledge of the casino, are we informed that he is only interested in the problem, and only later still do we learn that he works for the British Secret Service as code number 007. Pinky, too, has a three-digit code number. He tells Rose's phone number, 36s. You can remember that. Bond and Pinky are also both serious gamblers. While Bond gambles with his money and with his life, Pinky gambles with his salvation. Every day he makes the claim that between the stirrup and the ground, there will be enough time for him to repent. Pinky's religious element is not ignored by Fleming either. While Pinky, disgusted by women and sex, tells Dallow, "When I was a kid, I swore I'd be a priest, and of course there's a hell." Bond's most hellish novel, You Only Live Twice, requires him to be freed of his identity, worldly attachments, and relationships before his virtual death on a mission to Japan. Bond's mentor in Japan, Tiger Tanaka, jokingly calls him Bondo-san throughout the novel, a play on the Japanese word for priest, Bon-san. This is picked up again in the films, with the Daniel Craig Casino Royale asking M, "So you want me to be half-monk, half-hitman?" But speaking of vices and attachments, how could Pinky, a 17-year-old Catholic choir boy who doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, abhors sex, one has never left a few square miles of Brighton countryside, be related to Bond? The shaken, not stirred, martini-drinking agent who can have any girl he wants and is a globe-trotting adventurer to exotic places that we all know and love. These are Bond's most important qualities, right? Exactly. In fact, these qualities in Bond are the precise opposite of Pinky, that Bond drinks and smokes and Pinky doesn't. I lost my place. This inversion of Pinky's vices, or lack thereof, is a conscious tool Fleming uses to update his version of a Minuchin gangster for the new reality of the post-war period. And yet we see Bond's traits of these things as negatives, a womanizer, an alcoholic. Is Bond not so much of a warning of antisocial behavior as Pinky's? They are certainly both just as violent, and Bond more often than not recoils from any sort of loving attachment with women. When Vesper shows interest in him, notice how Fleming's description of Bond mimics Pinky's reaction to Rose. This is Bond speaking, or Fleming, I mean. Then at a hint that they were finding pleasure together, a hint that was only the first words of a conventional phrase, he had suddenly turned to ice and had brutally veered away as if warmth were poison to him. Much has been made of Jam Coetzee's identification that Pinky is some sort of fascist prototype that reflects growing trouble on the continent, a chilling specimen of the Adolf Hitler type, as Coetzee says. I disagree with this, as Coetzee's main evidence is the infamous description of Pinky as a young dictator, which I read that Green writes in sort of a pitying, mocking tone, especially because it follows Pinky's defeat on the race course. However, John le Carré may have been onto something in identifying this sort of maladjusted, militaristic, mythological zeitgeist as perhaps also occupying James Bond. In a 1966 interview, ironically with Malcolm Muggeridge, and its 2010 follow-up, le Carré calls Bond a neo-fascist gangster. Bond and Pinky both also face quasi-Jewish villains, Colleone and Le Chiffre. Bond and Pinky were both bullies at their childhood schools. Both grew up with no parents who died when they were at a young age. Both raised by ganglord fathers or schoolmaster fathers who look like they own the world. This is Pinky surrogate father Kite, Bond's ski instructor and SS member Hans Oberhauser, rich Jewish Italian mobster Colleone, and of course, M, Bond's boss. Now, some critics like Bernard Braganzi and R.W.B. Lewis have also made the connection that the character of Raven in Green's earlier A Gun for Sale is an early prototype version of Pinky. And what is Raven? an international assassin. We can also see how the gangster influence of Brighton Rock has been carried into the early films as well. The American release of the 1948 film was, after all, titled Young Scarface. While the first Bond film, the 1962 Dr. No, is shot in color, there is one moment in which the film is in black and white with a rather antiquated sound cue. The opening gun barrel sequence. We see Sean Connery's stunt double walk slowly into the black and white frame wearing a very un-Bond-like gangster fedora, not something he wears very much at all in the films, before hopping quickly into the frame, facing and then shooting the imagined viewer. I bring up that this is his stunt double because it's important to note that this isn't actually even Bond in the gun barrel sequence, but merely an anonymous gangster that we see from the opening of the film. Connery himself isn't even used as the walk-on person until Thunderball, the fourth movie. I'll end on Bond and Pinky's physical descriptions and mannerisms here before moving on to discuss some of the two novels' passages, but I wanted to highlight that at the end of Bright Rock, the priest tells Rose, "With your simplicity and his force, make him a saint." I believe we could say the same description of Bond with his force and his canonization in the realm of popular figures. Bond and Pinky are also the same age. Bond in 1938 would have been 17 years old. If one thinks of Bond as a grown-up Pinky, we're left with the sense that the conditions that produced Pinky, the council schooling, the bullying, the poverty, the underworld, the killing, would have resulted in a character quite similar to Bond in 1953 if Pinky had survived another 15 years. One of the most poignant points of comparison to be made between these two novels is in their respective denouements. For Brighton Rock, we know Pinky attempts to force Rose into a suicide pact, but at the last moment she betrays Pinky, turning from the darkness and refusing to commit suicide. It is Pinky who instead falls to his death, or in a manner of speaking, you could say he commits suicide through divine intervention. In her following confession, however, Rose wishes that she had found the courage to kill herself before walking rapidly in the thin June sunlight towards the worst horror of all, listening to Pinky's hateful gramophone record that he made for her. I want to emphasize that the message on this gramophone record is what Green chooses to end the book on. Let us go back to the passage from Pinky and Rose's honeymoon in which Pinky records the record. "It was a small glass box like a telephone cabinet. He went into the box and closed the door. He put in a sixpence, and speaking in a low voice for fear it might carry beyond the box, he gave his message to be graven on vulcanite. God damn you, you little bitch. Why can't you go back home forever and let me be?" I bring this up because of the ending of Casino Royale. Bond sets his mind to marry Vesper, another similarity to the Pinky Rose dynamic, and after a few days holiday in the French countryside, Bond wakes up to Vesper's suicide by sleeping pill overdose. Her notes says that she fell in love with Bond, but she's been a double agent for the Soviets because they've been holding her other boyfriend captive in Russia. She couldn't love them both and still betray Bond, or something like that. But unlike Brighton Rock, where Rose hadn't found the courage to commit suicide, in Casino Royale, Vesper does. Now listen to Bond's totally normal and totally healthy metamorphosis into Pinky in the closing lines of Casino Royale. "With a set, cold face, he walked down and shut himself in the telephone booth. He spoke quietly to the receiver. 'This is 007 speaking. This is an open line. It's an emergency. Can you hear me? Passes on at once. 3030 was a double working for Redland. Yes, damn it, I said was. The bitch is dead now.' The telephone booth, the recording and surveillance equipment, the cold and hateful demeanor, the quiet voice, the damn you, and the use of bitch. The parallels at even sentence level are too great to ignore. Even Pinky and Bond's deaths are near identical in situational context. Now, I do say Bond's death loosely, as Bond doesn't actually die and you only live twice, but this was Fleming's last complete, fully edited work, and Bond is grievously wounded by Blofeld's henchmen before washing up on a Japanese island with no memory of who he is, or where he is, or what he is. Note that the recent film No Time to Die lifts several elements from You Only Live Twice, Bond's death being one of them. Spoilers. Now, in Fleming's rather stunted and unedited Man with a Golden Gun that follows in the months leading up to his second heart attack and death, Bond is an aged shell of his former self and a completely changed character more in line with the new era of realistic spies by Dayton, Le Carre, and yes, Graham Greene. Here is the passage of which Bond is escaping Blofeld's castle by balloon, and he is shot with a burst of automatic gunfire. "The pain in his head was his whole universe. Below the softly swelling sea offered a bed. Bond let go with hands and feet and plummeted down towards peace, towards the rippling feathers of some childhood dream of softness and escape from pain. And Pinky's infamous death scene by his own sulfuric acid. He screamed and screamed with his hands up to his eyes. He turned and ran. It was as if the flames had literally got him and he shrank, shrank into a schoolboy flying in panic and pain. He was at the edge. He was over. They couldn't even hear a splash. It was as if he'd been withdrawn suddenly by a hand out of any existence, past or present, whipped away into zero, nothing. While Bond is saved in body, not really in mind, and Pinky is not saved in either, but possibly by God's salvation between the stirrup and the ground, we see at their ends how, out of everything, the importance of the broken schoolboy metaphor and the absence of a happy childhood leading to the demise of the mid-century British character. The parallels between Pinky and Bond, in my mind, means that either Fleming has really been mirroring or copying Greene after reading Bright Rock and Greene's other espionage entertainments in the years leading up to writing Casino Royale, or that the social forces of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s create circumstances surrounding writing in which these are the eventual outcomes of a character. I'm inclined to say both. I'm also inclined to say that this influence of the Pinky Greene gangster trope and the formation of Bond is still recurrent all the way up to Fleming's death in the 1960s. In 1961's Thunderball, the book opens with a very, very strange series of chapters in which Bond undergoes rehab for his heavy drinking and smoking in a Sussex community just outside Brighton. His cab driver to the nursing home, an expert car handler that Bond comments upon admiringly, is a young Brighton teenager who makes a worldly conversation with Bond about the excess of luxurious pleasures that sicken him in Brighton, the free and loose nature of the tarts available in Brighton, and how he knows Brighton well and will take Bond anywhere he wants to go, just call him up. Bond and this teenage taxi driver also discuss Brighton's crime. Bond says, "What car are you going to get?" "Volkswagen minibus, do the Brighton races." "That sounds a good idea. Plenty of money in Brighton." "I'll say," the young man showed a trace of enthusiasm. "Only time I ever got there, a couple of bookies had me take them and a couple of tarts to London. 10 quid and a fiver tip, piece of cake." "Certainly was, but you can get both kinds at Brighton. You want to watch out for being mugged and rolled. There are some tough gangs operating out of Brighton. What's happened to the bucket of blood these days?" "Never opened up again after that case they had, the one that got in all the papers." The young man realized he was talking as if to an equal. He glanced sideways and looked Bond up and down with a new interest. I believe we can all agree that Fleming here has acknowledged the influence of Pinky Brown in the creation of his character James Bond by inserting Pinky into the book and then having Bond have a very Brighton Rock-themed conversation with him. But enough of how Fleming has been influenced by Greene. Let's move on to how Greene was influenced by Fleming. The subject of this section is Greene's Loser Takes All. Serialized in 1954, published in 1955, and filmed in 1956. This novel, or should I say novella, as it is barely over 100 easy-to-read pages, to me seems one of Greene's forgotten books, stuck right between The End of the Affair and The Quiet American. Richard Greene tells us that Graham Greene was seized upon the idea for a novella in 1954, and Loser Takes All was written, quote, in a matter of weeks while staying at a hotel in Monte Carlo and conducting his research at the gaming tables. What I think is important to highlight about this novella is what year the novel comes. That is to say, less than a year after Casino Royale's publication, or rather, just 2 years after Greene visits Fleming in Jamaica, 1 month before the publication of Casino Royale, and that Greene, quote, being seized upon the idea, may not be out of the blue as Greene may have implied. Now, given Fleming's fervent admiration for Greene as an original voice in spy fiction, and this 1952 holiday in Jamaica quite possibly being Fleming's and Greene's first in-person informal meeting outside of maybe the Sunday Times offices or Bletchley Park, where they both worked in World War II, I find it extremely likely that Fleming brought up to Greene that he's just written a tragic spy novel, perhaps shown him his typescript or proofs, or even given him a proof or review copy. If Greene didn't read the novel then, he certainly would have seen it being advertised as one of the best-selling Jonathan Cape books of 1953, and it was being promoted in Les Touquettes, Deauville, and Monte Carlo as an entertaining gambling story. Strangely, Greene writes a disclaimer at the beginning of Loser Takes All stating that this frivolity has not been written for the purposes of encouraging adultery, nor is it meant to discourage gambling. Greene defending his frivolity as another one of his entertainments after several of his best serious novels is a message to his Catholic critics, sure, as he states in the disclaimer, but it can also be read to be defending such a short, loose, over-the-top, and fun novel as being just as good or as easy to write and sell as, you know, that popular Fleming trash that just came out. Now, as Carrie, the female lead in Loser Takes All, asks Bertram, the male lead in Gambler, "I thought someone broke the bank once," and he responds, "Only in a comic song, the bank can't lose." That comic song could very well be Casino Royale, and Green will show readers that he'll be writing a more serious and believable fairy tale than Fleming, as he does with his later spy fiction as well. At the very end of Loser Takes All comes an almost moralistic message from Druther, one of the sort of villains, to Bertram, but again it feels like a response to Fleming from Green. Druther says, "Be content with adventure and don't try to domesticate adventure." This does feel a bit rich coming from Green, however, given that his entertainments almost all involve domestic aspects, but this could be a message of, "Fleming, good try, but leave the real literature to the professionals, stick to adventure." Now, Loser Takes All, in brief, is about a minor corporate employee named Bertram, whose honeymoon plans with his second fiancée, Carrie, are changed by his boss, Druther, from Bournemouth to Monte Carlo. As Druther, or Gom, as Bertram calls him, says he will pay for it. Druther, however, fails to show, and Bertram runs out of money at the tables, has to be bailed out by the hotel manager, and so he comes up with a system to beat roulette and wins a large amount of money. And winning the money, Carrie no longer loves him since he's become obsessed with gambling, and so he instead gives up the money to be with her. I'm sure we can already see some basic similarities between Loser Takes All and Casino Royale already. Note that both Bertram and Bond begin with B, kind of like how Wormhole and Bond both have the same first names. But Bond and Bertram both first lose all of their money and are crushed before being saved by Deus Ex Machina, economic aid from the CIA and the hotel manager, respectively. Also, Bertram uses the word damn in vain a whole hell of a lot for a Green protagonist. On two facing pages, he says, "Doesn't care a damn, I'm damned if I'll apologize, and damn, damn, damn," which is just very Fleming-esque in how Bond's interior monologue is described. On the first and last page of the novella, Green makes direct reference to Les Touquettes. Remember earlier that I said Royale was based on Les Touquettes? With the first reference being an explicit decision not to go to Les Touquettes. You'd lose all our money at the casino. In other words, you could read this as Green staking his claim that this will be in a different location and a different type of gambling novel than Ian Fleming's. However, the last page is Carrie asking to go back to Les Touquettes, affecting an acknowledgement that Les Touquettes is where his novel feasibly begins out of the seed of Fleming's version of the seaside resort. The antagonists of Loser Takes All, the three corporate heads of the company Bertram works for, all have Bond villainesque nicknames, the Gom, the Blister, and A&N Other, and each possesses various physical disabilities that Fleming often gives his villains. Outside of Bertram and Carrie's casino exploits, the other remaining meta-plot deals with these three corporate heads' misappropriation of funds and a fight between controlling shares of the company, of which Bertram also enters into. These are the same reasons that Le Chiffre is gambling in Royale. We're almost done, I promise. Now, Green, in many instances in Loser Takes All, seems to be parodying Fleming, such as when Bertram complains about his ridiculously specific cocktail order that I quote in the opening of the presentation, a martini that is a near-exact copy of Bond's famous one that he orders in Casino Royale, the, quote, "dry martini in a deep champagne goblet, three measures of Gordon's, one of vodka, half a measure of quinoa lillet, shake it very well until it's ice cold, then add a large thin slice of lemon peel." However, sometimes Green seems to move beyond parody to just slightly revising the source material. In two different instances, Green lists the menu that Bertram and Carrie will eat at the casino. In the first instance, the dinner they imagine they will have when they're rich, and in the second, the actual dinner Bertram orders when he's one big. At Bertram's, Gordon's martini with lemon peel is included here. What is striking about these menus is that the catalog of items Bertram orders is nearly identical to the meals that enjoyed by Bond and Vesper in Casino Royale. The menu includes caviar, hot toast, vodka, specificity in wine and champagne. Bertram says again, very Bond-like, "I didn't care a damn about the Grand La Rose 1934. And later he sends it back for not being the correct temperature. But the weirdest food selection that is the same between Casino Royale and Loser Takes All is a focus on wild strawberries in all the menus. However, in classic Green fashion, Carrie takes the meal a little more dramatically by instead ordering a roll in butter and a cup of coffee, much to Bertram's outrage after his long, very Bond-like order. It is clear that the gastronomical particulars of Bond were of great interest to Green, not only for this parallel in Loser Takes All, but also because the specific scene in which Bond orders dinner is the extract of Casino Royale that Green selects for the spy's bedside book under the heading Blanc de Brut 1943. In addition to the focus on specificity in food and drink in Loser Takes All, Green spends, in my opinion, an uncharacteristic amount of time describing the workings of the casino in Monte Carlo, with detailed descriptions of the hotel, the staff, the managers, the waiters, the doormen, the liftmen, the man always at your elbow to light your cigarette. He describes the methods of game playing and system making for roulette. He focuses on the various players of the game and their personal lives, the clothes they're wearing, the food they're eating, and the divisions between spaces in the casino, the three hotel rooms of Bertram and Carey, the restaurant, bar, cafe, casino floor, and the salle privée of the main hotel. Usually Green focuses on a few disparate and hazy objects in a room. Like in Bright Rock, Pinky's room is like the brass bedstand and the crumbs on the floor and the soap dish. But here, this is not the case in Loser Takes All. And I argue that this is sort of coming from Fleming's writing, because it is a trademark of Fleming's writing to give such specific details. This is something that Kingsley Amis calls the Fleming effect, or the way in which Fleming gives specific everyday details, such as brand names, so that the average reader can understand, appreciate, and potentially purchase or live in these objects to feel like Bond, especially in cases of gaming, food, and commercial shopping. A great example of this in Loser Takes All is when Bertram and Carey dream up all the things they'll be able to buy upon winning. A toothbrush at Cartier's, Lanvin for two pajama tops, soap at Guerlain. Oh, okay. Anyways, I hope to have demonstrated today some of the most enlightening and surprising similarities between the work of Ian Fleming and Graham Greene in my case study. The back and forth revision or parody between them provides evidence for the creation of what I term the intermodernist thriller. In some ways, James Bond is a revision of Pinky Brown for the post-war period, and the similarities between these two continue throughout the rest of Fleming's life and writing career, up to and including the character's death in 1964's You Only Live Twice. On the other hand, Pinky is not even the beginning of Green's obsession with doomed, whiskey-soused, middle-aged men that continues throughout the rest of his writing career. But we can see how, in return, the specter of Bond leaves an indelible mark on the remainder of Green's espionage fiction into at least the late 70s, as Fleming's work reshapes the thriller battlefield. Green immediately begins to respond to such a forceful character as James Bond represents, as Loser Takes All makes clear. In this way, continuing to write entertainments in the midst of his serious Catholic novels is a return to form for Green, as he indirectly pays homage to himself through Fleming's character that is in turn modeled on Green's. Fleming maintained his respect and admiration for Green all the way up until the end of his life, as in a 1964 interview, just a few months before his death, Fleming stated that, "I should think that the great War and Peace thriller would be more likely to be written by a man like Graham Greene, because he would do it more truthfully and accurately than I ever could." Nonetheless, despite his faults, or perhaps both of their faults, Ian Fleming deserves just as much recognition for his contribution to mid-century British literary culture as Graham Greene does, and I very much appreciate you all coming today to hear about my PhD research on these two topics. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucas, for a heady cocktail of a presentation that leaves us with much more than a single green olive to digest. I'm sure while you were listening to that, you were thinking of questions, queries. We'll start here at the front.
Thank you. I've actually got two questions. One, I read the James Bond short story, The Quantum of Solace.
Yes, of course.
And at the end of it, I thought, I've just read a Somerset Maugham short story.
You sure have. Actually, Fleming and Somerset Maugham lived in the same apartment building in London. But he was good friends with him, and on his trip to Japan to research, Somerset Maugham hosted him.
That's what I was going to say. And again, the sort of spy connection, of course, Ashenden.
So yes,
again,
yes, which is a fantastic novel, and I highly recommend.
So it's that sort of literary imitation. So that's the first question. The second question, is there ever been a weirder literary adaptation than the 1960s Casino Royale film?
You mean the one with David Niven in it?
Well, and Ronnie Corbett.
Yes, yes. Well, and Orson Welles and everything. Well, When Fleming had his mind's eye on an actor for Bond, he picked David Niven. And they went with Sean Connery because they wanted someone a little more, you know, sort of bulky.
Cheaper.
What's that?
Cheaper as well.
Yes, yes, indeed. Well, nobody had heard of, you know, the, quote, Scottish peasant of Sean Connery before Dr. No. And it is really quite crazy with Sean Connery. They had to put him through, like, etiquette school and such for him to learn how to be Bond. But speaking of that, that is a very strange adaptation. It's obviously a comedy or a parody. It has a lot of big-name actors in it. What was your question? I'm sorry.
Just how weird it was.
Yes, it is indeed.
At the end, George Raft turns up. Joshua Belmondo makes an appearance.
Yes, right.
The Monte Carlo police commissioner's talking in a Scottish accent.
Yeah, yeah.
Sterling Moss is in there.
Very shortly.
It's like LSD.
Very shortly after that film, they made a not a Bond film. It was about James Bond's brother, and it was played by Sean Connery's brother, and they brought, I don't remember the name of
it. It was Italians, I think.
Yes, but it brought over all the actors from, I think, that film and from a lot of the earlier Bond films. So it's just very strange, the whole film industry. Yeah, but, yeah, thank you.
Hi, thanks so much for that. It's so engaging. One quick thought is that you can get some mileage out of the Ministry of Fear on the loss of memory. Yeah. Okay. But my actual question is about casinos. I know that there's a gambling background in Brighton Rock because the horse races, right? But in the 50s, Green uses a whole lot of casinos and from then on. So we got, Loser Takes All. We have Armand Nirvana.
And the comedians.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, I would like to get you to talk about that because it seems like casinos become quite a thing for Graham Greene going forward.
Well, I guess I hadn't really thought about it in that way that Greene, you know, continues to use casinos, but I think in a way it has to go to the success and popularity of Fleming. And the fact that it had these interconnection stuff, but also that in World War II, most SIS agents met their contacts in casinos, usually in Portugal, and in a city called Estoril, near Lisbon. And the inspiration for the scene in Casino Royale, where Bond faces, you know, Le Chiffre at Baccarat, was based on Ian Fleming going to Portugal and attempting to win Baccarat against Nazi agents that were at the table there. He lost all his money, but but anyways, I think there's something about the space of a casino just being a place of high wealth where Loser Takes All, not really. It's almost like a, I know Green hates Greenland, but it's like a Greenland in a building that you can take and move to Haiti or to France or Cuba. There's something else about it. You mentioned the Brighton Rock of the gambling background. There's another thing, and I bring this up in my other chapter of my PhD, is the fact that this is set in northern France, Casino Royale set in northern France. Right across the channel is Brighton, and how Fleming describes Royale, this fictional seaside resort, is not very French. He describes it much more like Brighton. And I did some digging, and I was trying to figure out why was Fleming describing Royale as if it was Brighton? And casinos are illegal in the UK until 1960. And I always get the sense that Fleming would have put Casino Royale, or in a gambling hub as Brighton, if it was legal, if that makes sense. I've gone on a tangent here, but I still appreciate the question, Richard. Yeah,
on that, did Fleming ever go to, because he was having an affair with wife before he married her, did they have it in Brighton? Because he always had that reputation.
Not with Anne Charteris, I believe, but with one of his other...
He did go to Brighton.
Yes, he did. Dorothy Glover was, this is sort of... a blonde motorcycle dispatch rider that Fleming was madly in love with. She got killed in the Blitz, but they used to go to Brighton quite frequently. Yes, indeed. Yeah. Anything else?
Lucas,
yes.
In terms of alcoholic consumption, who wins, Fleming or Green?
Well, I think because, you know, Fleming dies 30 years earlier, I think Fleming wins. Yeah, or loses. Yeah, but that's a good one though. That's why that's actually what, one of the things that drew me together on Green and Fleming originally is just the amount of affairs and alcohol that is between them. And indeed, but has anyone had that Graham Greene cocktail that's like the creme de cassis that he made in Indochina? I've just always wanted to try it. Yeah. Okay, that's all.
But we can try it after the film tonight.
Yes, indeed.
We can ask.
Any other questions?
Thank you for that, Lucas. That was really, really interesting and makes me, want to follow some of the roads that you've led us down, there's this shared world that you very convincingly showed us was because Fleming's background and Green's, you know, in many ways they shared a great deal. And the alcohol when they got older and the impressive meals and so on. There's the opposite of that. I'm thinking of in the human factor, the way Dantry doesn't understand what Maltesers are.
Yeah.
That seems to me to indicate that Green was onto the fact that there is a world in which Maltesers are more alien than the most sort of exotic
yes.
wine or the, you know, a casino. It's the world of possibly children and domesticity.
Yes.
And would you agree that that was lacking for Fleming as well as for, you know, that in the work, it is a very adult world, isn't it? It's, I'm going to coin a phrase here, a sort of a non-Malteser world.
I think I understand what you're asking, Karina. Thank you for the question. You said just like that through these sort of thriller novels, or at least like Fleming's, it's more of just a adult exploration of child spaces. Is that? Yeah, I think that definitely comes out in some places in Fleming for sure. The opening of Honor Majesty's Secret Service is Bond thinking about. Well, there's many things where they talk about, and this is actually Fleming and Green. They talk about espionage being a game. You know, Fleming calls it his game of Red Indians, which he did in World War II. That's what he calls commander raids. But about espionage being a game and that you have to know the rules for it and that, you know, there's secret passwords. And I suppose Daintree and the human factor, even though he's the new broom or whatever to sweep out MI6, he doesn't know all the secret handshakes. He's not part of the old boys network, which if you think about it, the old boys network is created in, you know, like a young adulthood, which is kind of that... that childhood space. But yes, sorry, just on the Maltesers, at the beginning of Our Majesty's Secret Service, that Bond is dreaming about Cadbury chocolate flakes and fizzy lemonade, and that's all he wants. Instead, he doesn't want martinis, he doesn't want caviar, he wants Cadbury chocolate flakes. And I just think that's very interesting. I'll have to use that. Now, thank you, Karina.
In terms of other contemporaries, how did they, you mentioned Marguerite, you mentioned Le Carré and that interview where they're talking quite negatively about Fleming's Bond and a bit more praiseworthy about Green. Yeah. Are there any other, as well as, well, them and the other contemporaries, what were their views? How did they compare Fleming and Green, both their work and them as men? Right.
I kind of get the sense that all the sort of the postmodern spy fiction writers, so that's like Le Carré, Len Dayton, Frederick Forsyth, all of them, none of them like Fleming, and all of them like Green, because they want to write the dirty, boring, you know, story of moving files and boring libraries for 600 pages. I don't like Le Carré, but but that's. And it's just something, I think we're almost getting a rediscovery of Fleming. Well, in critical studies, there's, you know, there's the journal and stuff, but there's a lot of new books being published about Fleming, and a lot of new spy fiction in the last 10, 15 years is much more of the, you know, calling back to John Buchan and Erskine Childers than it is calling to, you know, Le Carré or any of that sort of dirty world of espionage, just because I think it's been done, if that makes sense. I think Le Carré probably, you know, used up all the ammunition for that kind of world, and so did Len Dayton. And again, I'm losing your question. What was it, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, just what other, you know, how others compared them, really. You know, as you say, that there seems to be a preference for Green, but I think in terms of popularity...
Yeah.
Sales, films, I suppose Fleming wins it, doesn't he?
He does, but I think there's something about, you know, if it's popular, it's not literary. If it's popular, it's meant for the, you know, the working class, mass genre type stuff. And, you know, Green in his Catholic novels, Green would never stoop to that, thrillers type stuff. And then yet when he writes his Catholic novels like The Power and the Glory, which is, you know, a policeman chasing a fugitive, and The Heart of the Matter is about diamond smuggling, he uses just as many thriller tropes to write his Catholic novels. So I think it's a bit unfair towards Fleming and Malcolm Muggeridge and people like Bernard Berganzi and other writers after Fleming's death really did a number on his reputation that's stuck with us to this day. But I hope that answers your question.
Sorry, thanks, Lucas. And just to go on from Chris's point, I just sort of mentioned Evelyn Waugh, who was another one who really didn't like Fleming, though he stayed with him, I believe, also at Goldeneye.
Well, he was good friends with his wife.
Yeah. There was a little bit of interaction between them. So Waugh, who was recognised as a literary writer, his second novel, Vile Bodies, many of you might remember, features a character called Lady Fanny Throbbing. Now, Lady Fanny Throbbing came from a bit from Ronald Furbank, and surely Ian Fleming took a little bit out of that when he moved on to Pussy Galore.
Sure, yeah. I would say that, yes, the amusing names for heroines and villains, I think is kind of a callback to Evelyn Waugh type stuff, just when all those characters sound like Trimbley Wimblows or whatever, you know. I did think of one author that does like Fleming, and that's Kingsley Amis. He was the first person to write a Bond continuation novel and these other studies and such. And he was still part of that, the Look Back in Anger kind of generation. Yes, thank you. Which could argue that Fleming, in a way, is a part of those as well. But
yeah, I've got a. It's probably more of an observation, Lucas. I thought it was interesting you said quite early in your discussions and talk that Fleming wrote his Bond books all in succession. So I don't know what his first one started with, let's say 1954, and for the next 12 years he kept writing one every year. I was wondering why that was so, and would you make a comparison to him and Green, who maybe went long periods of time of not writing a book?
Well, Fleming had a two-month holiday in Jamaica for like January and February of every year, and it made him a lot of money, and he also enjoyed doing it, and my master's thesis mentor, who just did a biography of Fleming, says that he sort of did it to, you know, well, and this is not a very far, you know, leap that people can figure out, but sort of to get the excitement that he never got in the war, because, you know, Fleming never was a cool secret agent. Fleming was essentially Moneypenny in World War II. he really was. But he organized these commandos and other double agents and things that he never got to be. And it's almost him sort of living out those experiences, especially when he would often go to Jamaica alone. His wife hated it there. He had no friends. His wife hated his literature. All her friends hated his literature. And so it's just something for him to do. But you were comparing Green and how they wrote. What I guess kind of stands out to me was Green's writing process on The Confidential Agent, right? Where he, you know, did a bunch of Benzedrine and wrote it in like 6 weeks while also writing The Power and the Glory. And there is something sort of addictive, I think, about the thriller genre and combined with the drinking and the drugs, right? That sort of spurs both of them on. Is that, maybe that's your question?
Yeah, but I just thought it was, I'm not trying to make a comparison at all with somebody like the Harry Potter books, but it seemed like the James Bond books were just churned out one after another. And was that a financial aspect of that, or he just felt that he could just keep writing these type of books so quickly? I just thought the number of books in such a short time was quite probably very unusual, I would imagine.
Sure, yeah, well, I think it was definitely financial for one thing. But the other thing was that he did not like writing the Bond books. He tried to kill Bond off many times. And he always tried to turn to other forms of journalism and children's books and short stories, and nobody liked those. And so it's almost like, you know, depresses him more, right? Because Fleming was a very, what is the term for, the humor, the four humors. Fleming was the sad one. Yes, thank you. So I think he enjoyed doing it. I mean, Fleming always tried to be a literary writer. He wanted to be accepted as a literary writer. And you could see in his sort of careful editing and his notes and stuff that he really wanted to be a literary writer, but no one accepted it for him to be one, if that makes sense. So I think it was one day he was going to prove himself that he would write a Ambler Green level thriller. And it's up to you if he ever achieved that, but I don't think Fleming ever felt that he did that in his life.
Thank you again, Lucas. Left us a lot to chew on. We've now got half an hour until the next paper at 4 by Philip Ombre. Thank you.